I'm Liz Joyner, Executive Director of the Village Square.
And I'm Bill Maddox, a member of the Board of Directors of the Village Square. We'd like to welcome you to You've Come a Long Way, Baby, The Politics of the Feminine. We're delighted to be partnering tonight with the Oasis Center for Women and Girls, which works to improve the lives of women and girls through celebration and support. They brought you copies of the executive summary of the Leon County Commission on the Status of Women and Girls, and we'll share a word about that later this evening. There should be copies on all of your tables.
Tonight's program is made possible by the generous support of Zisfer Stansberry Advertising and Public Relations, which is supportive of nonprofits across the community, MedAffinity, a Tallahassee-based company providing electronic health record software for doctors. Neil Skeen with MedAffinity is here tonight. Neil, thank you. And Tallahassee Memorial Women's Pavilion. Warren Jones from Tallahassee Memorial is also here this evening somewhere. Thank you, Warren. Support from our sponsors makes it possible for us to keep our membership fee and dinner prices affordable while we bring you great programs. We are very grateful to them. And I'm going to hand it over to Bill.
All right. So the way our program tonight's going to work is similar to those of you who watch one of my favorite shows, Morning Joe, on MSNBC. We're going to do something similar to that tonight. Lecrae and I are going to first invite two of our panelists up, and then we will, over the course of the evening, add a couple of additional panelists, and I think you'll enjoy hearing from all of them. It's first my pleasure to welcome Stacy Fox. Stacy has been with Planned Parenthood over 15 years, currently serving as the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of North Florida. In February, Stacy will be stepping into the CEO role at Planned Parenthood of the Southeast, serving Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi. Stacy is a strong advocate for social justice and has served as a volunteer and board member for local and national LGBT organizations. She has also participated at many levels of local politics. Please join me in welcoming Stacy Fox.
And it is now my pleasure to introduce to the stage Suzanne Vinker. Teacher turned author and social critic, Suzanne has written extensively about politics, parenting, and the influence of feminism on American society. Her writing has appeared in the New York Post, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Parents.com. Her books include the forthcoming How to Choose a Husband, The Seven Myths of Working Mothers, and The Flip Side of Feminism, co-authored with her aunt, Phyllis Schlafly. Suzanne has been on a wild ride the past month after writing an article for Fox News titled The War on Men. Please help me introduce and welcome Ms. Suzanne Vinker.
All right, so the way this is going to work tonight is we've got a couple of scripted questions, but what we really want is not for this to look in any way like your typical debate. In fact, one of the reasons why I was so slow to agree to do this is because I told Liz, I said, I don't want to be a part of the same old conversation or debate. So we've got some questions that we want to bring to the table to get the conversation going, but what we hope will happen now is just a dialogue. Among women who might be in a living room. In fact, Suzanne, move over here closer if you would, just so that we can.
Can I bring my water?
Conversation, yeah.
Watch out for your feet.
And what we want is for you, as you're listening, to be thinking of questions that you might like to ask, because we'll want you to take part in the discussion as we go along. But Lecrae's going to get us started with the first question.
I'm shorter and smaller over on this chair.
The title of tonight's program presupposes that women are on a path to some destination. What is that destination? What do you personally see and want women to reach? And how would you define equality with men? Is it reaching a point where men and women are virtually interchangeable? Or is it reaching a point where men and women are seen as equals, even though they are seen as quite different as well? Who wants to start this thing off for us?
Is that for me? So I have what might be an interesting or unusual perspective on the issue of gender equality. and the just general male-female relations. I think men and women are equal, and that they've had, and that they have been equal for a very long time. I think that they are very different. They come in, they come out of the womb, or in the womb, they start in the womb that way. And we have gotten away from understanding the fundamental differences between women and men by focusing so much on this notion of equality. So one of the things that I do in my work and with my writing, and I have several things coming out imminently, in the next couple weeks actually, on this issue, is try to get people to think very differently from the way the culture has taught them to think about this issue. Is that an okay start?
That's good.
Now, do you want...
Yeah.
I can expound, but I don't want to...
Well, we got all night.
Okay.
Stacy.
Okay, I think that's a great question. One of the first things that came to mind for me is one of the things that comes out of my mouth really often is providing an equal seat at life's table. To me, it's really about equal opportunity for women and men. And I would, you know, disagree with Suzanne that, you know, men and women have equal opportunity and that we are really equal. But I do think that we have to nurture the differences and understand the differences between men and women. And I think, you know, in the early ages of feminism, we were working towards, women were working towards fitting into a man's world. Well, that's not always necessarily the case anymore. And so I think some men could certainly benefit from the things that women bring to the workplace and to politics, you know, leaning more towards the feminine side as, you know, women learn from, you know, what men bring to the table as well. So I think it's a blend of what you were asking of celebrating the differences and allowing those differences at the table, but making sure that women and men have equal opportunities to get to the table.
So what would be an example of your feelings that they do not have equal opportunity to get to the table?
Well, I think that's a good question, Suzanne. It sort of leads into the point, I think, where we differ about women and parenting. And I think that we don't offer women an equal opportunity to get back into the workplace. There isn't a place held for women, I don't think, for women to get back into the workplace where they left, to pick up where they left off, really, and move forward. We have a culture that sort of penalizes women for making a choice to stay home and parent. And so if women want to be in the workplace, we don't provide them an equal opportunity in that way.
So your argument is that equal opportunity means that if you step out, let's say at 35 from your job, to raise children for, let's say, 10 years, then at 45, you sort of have the right, if you will, to step back in where you were at 35.
Well, I think when you're looking at someone's resume, if someone's taken off 10 years to go parent, that's not a ding on them, but that's seen as a, you know, something very valuable and contributory, just in a different way. I've looked at resumes for years, and I think when people look at resumes and they're looking at when people jump jobs or take time off from jobs, that's not taken very kindly.
So what happens when they're up against the person who is still there from 35 to 45 going farther than she
was? I'm not talking about qualification. I mean, obviously somebody who's been in the job 10 years longer is going to be differently qualified. But I think when we penalize women to take time off away from the workplace, and we don't give them the credibility that they deserve to come back in.
Let me ask you on this question. I hadn't anticipated we'd get to this quite so soon, but that's fine. I had a fascinating conversation with my 20-something-year-old daughter, and she was relaying to me a conversation that she had had with one of her male friends, guy that lives in her apartment complex. And he had recently graduated from college, is now working as a preschool teacher, which is what he had been trained to do. And he said this to her. He said, "Someday I'd really like to be a stay-at-home dad. That would be cool. But I guess it kind of sucks that stay-at-home motherhood probably wouldn't be an option for you someday, since there's a stigma now attached with it." So my question is, as we're considering progress, or kind of where we are, notice that, of course, that The title of our discussion tonight is "You've Come a Long Way, Baby?" Question mark. Are the kinds of attitudes that this young man is articulating, are they a sign in your mind of progress or a sign of regress?
Regress.
I would disagree. I think it's a sign of progress.
Let's let Stacey in. I want to hear from both of you.
I think that feminism, as it was originally designed, has to change. I think of this just in the work that I do around using the terminology pro-choice. That does not resonate with the next generation of women. And what our first wave of champion feminists did for women, and the messages and language and progress that they made doesn't resonate with our third and fourth wave feminists. They have to redefine it for themselves. I was just going back and looking at Anne-Marie Slaughter's article that she wrote about, you know, stepping away from her job and you know, that women still can't have it all. If you haven't read it, I think it's a good piece to be thinking about. You know, it certainly came to mind when you mentioned this. And, you know, whether women can have families and work, but I think more of it is not blaming feminism for this, but understanding how our work lives are set up so that it doesn't really support either men or women staying home with their children. So I really think it's progress. The movement hasn't changed. It has to change. The guardrails aren't the same as feminism has moved through the ages. And I look out and see some really, you know, young faces in the room. And for those women who identify as feminists, as young feminists, they're going to define what feminism is today. It's not the same feminism. So I think when some of the old guard, if you will, is saying, well, it's not, you know, we still can't have it all because that's what we were fighting for, that's not bad, and that's not regression.
Okay. Jump in, Suzanne.
So the reason why that conflict exists and will always exist and always has existed is because there is a natural, inherent conflict between raising children and pursuing demanding careers. Those two things are incompatible because children need a parent's attention most of their waking hours. If you are engaged elsewhere, emotionally and physically, you're not going to be able to tend to that task the way you want to, and vice versa. You're not going to be able to tend to your work the way you want to. If you read any of the literature, women's literature, or women's magazines about this issue, including the Anne-Marie Slaughter article, it's the same sort of realization or theme, if you will, in all of the articles, which is that this isn't working. And Anne-Marie Slaughter's was one of them. She thought she could literally live in another state from her teenage boys and there wouldn't be any fallout. So she realizes finally, late in the game, that, wow, her sons or children really do need a mom there, like in the state, in the house. And so she realizes it and comes home to address it and takes a different job locally and more part-time, if you will, so she can address that part of her life. And yet the solution in her article was still government-based. In other words, here's what government needs to do, here's how society needs to change, rather than just recognizing the theme of basically my work, which is that these two things are inherently incompatible. And we need to address that, accept it, and not scream and shout that the world's against you or that the government's against you.
All right, I wouldn't disagree with that. I just want to say, reading the end of Anne-Marie Slaughter's article, I think is really poignant because she speaks and she writes and says, I'm speaking from a place of privilege. You know, she had the privilege to go work for the government and leave Princeton for 2 years. But most women who are struggling to balance work and family lives don't have that privilege. And the idea of feminism is not even relevant to them, and equality. So I think that's another piece to the puzzle, is understanding the lens at which we're looking at this. Is that, you know, for those of us who have the ability to think about a demanding career and a family, because we have some leeway with that, there are thousands and millions of families and women who don't. So I think that's important to keep that.
Okay, so let me just go back here, because I want to tease out your response. you're saying that there's an incompatibility between work and family, especially when children are young. And yet the young man that my daughter was talking to was acknowledging that and was simply saying that he would like to be the one that would fulfill that role of being the primary caretaker rather than his wife. So the question on that point is, does that make any difference?
A man or a woman, is that what you're asking?
In general, does it make any difference?
Yes. Should we welcome that just as much as we would a stay-at-home mother?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and I think...
All right, so wait a minute. Help me here. You guys began the conversation. Remember, I am but a man.
You aren't but a man. You are a man. Be proud.
On all questions that we are dealing with tonight, I am clueless.
No, you're not.
And I live, as all men do, in utter a continual state of confusion about what women want. So here's...
Instead of women, sometimes. We're confused, too, sometimes. It's okay.
So here's my question. You guys began the evening both articulating the idea that you believed in equality, but that you felt like there were important differences between men and women. And yet on the very first question of the night about work and family, you're arguing both, it seems to me, that really men and women are interchangeable. Whether it's mom or dad makes no difference.
No. Well, that's why I asked you, to whom does it matter? That's why I asked. Do you mean, like, morally speaking, does it matter whether the father or the mother stays home? Or do you mean, is there any difference in the lives of the children, are they interchangeable? In which case, I would say...
Any of the above. Yeah.
So, do I have any opinion or cast any judgment on whether or not fathers versus mothers stay home? No. Do I think there's a different experience from the child's perspective as to whether or not they're raised by a male or a female, a father or a mother? Absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think women and men are interchangeable at all. And I would agree with Suzanne. I mean, they both bring unique... skill sets and, you know, brain power to the experience. LeCrae's original question, I don't think we should be shooting for a society where men and women are interchangeable. That's not what I think equality about. What equality about is what I said is, let's get everybody to the same, give the opportunity to get to the same place, and then people make their own choices. They stay at home, they work, the dad stays at home, or the kid's parented by, you know, other...
But so overwhelmingly, women are the ones who do choose to stay home overwhelmingly.
Okay, hold that thought because we'll come back to it because we've got a lot to discover yet this evening. But I want to pick up on this comment. Accepting that we aren't going to all agree that men and women should be interchangeable or not or whatnot, put yourself in this room 50 years from now where there's a conversation taking place much like tonight. And the question is, have we made progress in the roles and relationships of men and women since 2013? And the question that I want you guys to hear from you is, will the state of play 50 years from now, ideally, be one in which the men and women, their identities are becoming more and more like each other, not interchangeable, but like each other? Or will they be more and more different, though equal? Because I think we all agree that equality is... I mean, do either of you...
And I'd like to add to that question, is one path better than another? When you answer that, you know, is one more ideally what we're going towards? You know, my original question was, is there a destination? That destination, is one better than the other on those two?
Well, I think, like I was saying, in early feminism, right, women were trying to find an equal footing. And when we're talking about business and, you know, corporate America and places where women were working to insert themselves, they had to look more like men in order to fit in because there weren't very many female faces. But that's changed. And so I think that the 50 years from now, if we can embrace the differences of men and women, allow space for men and women to exist equally, then that would be my goal. You know, I mean, I hate to throw this out there, but I'm going to, because it keeps coming up over and over. that we still live in a rape culture. You know, I mean, we live in a place where men exert their power over women. And I think, you know, the Women and Girls Report that just came out about Leon County, a third of women who were beaten or died in Leon County were related to domestic violence situations. I mean, that is not equality. So to me, 50 years from now, that's what goes away. That's the piece of equality that needs to change.
What was the question?
future. Yeah. So I would like to see less focus on this idea of... See, I think progress in a culture can coexist with tradition. And I think that's where the whole cultural dialogue gets lost, is you have this huge divide between progressives and traditionalists. And I think most of us fall somewhere in the middle. I don't know about you guys, but I happen to think that there are some things that are traditional or classic, if you will, that never go out of style and don't need progress. Take the little black dress, right? Women need a little black cocktail dress in their closet. No matter what year it is, it's always going to work. There are some things that just don't change, and human nature is one of them. So the fact that men have certain traits that they bring to the table and women do doesn't need to change just because we progress as a culture. So I think the focus on progress is, when it comes to this topic anyway, men and male-female relations, isn't the right one.
All right, I want to pull Lecrae in, not as a moderator, but I want you to take your moderator hat off and just tell me, a lot of young women your age in college, I know, are wrestling with these sorts of questions as they think ahead in terms of their future careers and family lives and whatnot. What do you see and observe on your campus and among the people of your generation on some of these questions that we've been wrestling with?
Right, and I'm glad you asked that. I actually want to backtrack a little bit, if we can, to the comment that was made by your daughter's friend about her not being... If you would you repeat that really quick?
Yeah, well, he says, it kind of sucks that stay-at-home motherhood probably wouldn't be an option for you someday since there's a stigma associated with it. So he perceived there was no stigma associated with a guy staying home, but there would be one with a woman. Now, keep in mind, my daughter's in Hollywood, and so you get...
Oh, yeah, that's a mess. That's a real mess.
That's real life.
You get the skewed version of California. But at any rate, that was his perception, so go.
Right. No, and I think that's that goes hand-in-hand with the question about what do I see on campus for myself and what pattern I see with young women my age. My friends and I have conversations over... the stay-at-home mom and the idea of what we want for our careers all the time. And I would go as far to say that it really just depends on the individual, you know? And that's what I was, you know, I was going to plug in a little bit earlier, too. I think that whether to label that as progress or regression, it depends on the individual. I know a lot of the young ladies at my university, I attend Florida A&M University, are like me. You know, striving to obtain a degree, and we want to one day pursue careers in that degree. And maybe we don't want to take the time out to per se serve as a stay-at-home mom, but we don't look down on that. I don't think we see that as negative at all. One of my best guy friends, his mom is a stay-at-home mom, was a stay-at-home mom, and he's a great guy. We've seen, you know, in our culture and we've seen in our age where being a stay-at-home mom or being a working mom can play out in different roles. In some situations, one pathway is more feasible than it would be. You know, a lot of different variables go into that. So to answer it, not to veer too far off to bring it back in, you know, for my age, I do think it depends on the individual, whether or not, you know, the idea of a woman's role being... I don't even like to term it like that. You know, it depends on the woman, whether or not she wants to pursue a career or to serve as a stay-at-home mom. And I don't think one is better or worse than the other.
Look, there needs to be room for both, right? I mean, I think what if we took women out of politics completely, we took women out of the workforce completely, we'd be missing a huge richness of the population, right? So we have to make room for both. We've got to make room for women you know, who choose that path, men who choose that path, and those who choose to go into the workforce.
Right now, I need to make room for a woman in the back of the room who is waving and telling me that we need to throw open for any questions that you guys may have. And while you're identifying your interest in asking a question, I want to invite up another guest who I think you guys are going to really enjoy and who has an awful lot to add to our conversation, and that is Rosalind Fuse-Hall is the executive director of Title III programs at Florida A&M University. Roz is a graduate of the Rutgers School of Law and an Eisenhower Fellow. She's been a leader in higher education for decades at UNC, NCCU, and FAMU. She's worked as the chief of staff in the office of the president at FAMU, as executive assistant to the chancellor and acting vice chancellor at North Carolina Central University, and as secretary of the university and associate dean at UNC Chapel Hill. Roz has taken a special interest over the years in women's issues, is obviously a very accomplished professional woman, and also mother of a soon-to-be graduate of the University of North Carolina also.
Go Tar Heels.
Yeah. Welcome, Roz. Thank you. Yes. Okay, do we have any questions from the audience at this time? There is one in the back, and then we're going to pull from Roz.
Okay, I have two questions, and you can just pick one. What opportunities do women living in poverty have to choose the option of staying at home to care for their children? And aren't we really talking about rigidly defined gender roles as opposed to loosely defined gender roles rather than just what women and men are equal at?
Good. I like the second question. Somebody want to jump on that? Are we looking for rigidly defined gender roles or loosely defined gender roles or any gender roles at all?
I think that's really a great question, and my work speaks to that directly. A lot of times you have this divide between the right or the left, or the traditionalists versus the progressives, and the thinking is that, you know, traditionalists are locked in this place of rigidity. Now, maybe some are. I am not one of them. And I don't think that the rigid traditionalist is the norm. I think there is a place for common sense, reasonable recognition of natural gender roles and the things, again, that men and women bring to the table that's unique while still being flexible. So, for example, let's take the issue that I talk about in my writing as far as men wanting to be providers and protectors. I think that is a natural, inherent desire of most men, not all men, but most men. And that just because I encourage women to let men take on that role because it is part of their DNA, if you will, doesn't mean they don't ever change diapers, and doesn't ever mean you won't have a job. It just means that you recognize that that's their core center, just like nurturing is a female or average woman's core center. So to me, recognizing that doesn't mean no man does the dishes and no woman holds a job.
Well, and I think it also, you know, we have to look at the evolution of the study of gender, right? I mean, back in the day, we were studying the socialization of gender, right? And then that's what defined gender. But then we kind of start to begin to understand the biology of gender, right? And there is some physiological markers to our gender roles, and you can't ignore those, right? I mean, the corpus callosum of a female's brain is thinner than a male's brain, and so it speaks to how their brain functions. So you can go home and tell your partner that, whichever works for you. But you can't ignore that biology. You know, I think that's what you were saying, Suzanne, right? That's the innate part, and we've got to incorporate that. But I think as we've learned in society, that labels just aren't really working for us. And so I think my answer to your question about gender roles would be, if we could just get rid of gender roles as we've defined them, would be great, because they just don't work anymore. But I think we also can't ignore the biology of gender. And
well,
some of those things are
how do you
innate.
Not ignore the biology, but then get rid of traditional gender roles altogether? I don't understand that
connection. Hold that thought. I want to pull Roz in. Roz, tell us where we're going wrong. Set us straight.
Well,
help us out.
One thing I'd like to offer as a difference is that 50 years from now, our children, based on my interaction with my children, my godchildren, the wonderful students I have the opportunity to work with, just see the difference, because there is evolution in what they've grown up with, what they've learned, what they've been exposed to. There is an evolution. And so in my mind, those gender labels will be very different 50 years from now than they are currently right now. And what they define as their traditions may be a little different than what we grew up with as traditions. And if we look back in history, we will know that traditions have changed over time. So evolution, I think, is the role and where we need to go with this. And we will stop talking about mommies and daddies, and we'll talk about parents. And maybe there'll be two parents in the home, or three, or four. I come out of a tradition where the extended family is very much a part of that nurturing parenting program for children to become wonderful adults who have the eagerness, the creativity, the intelligence, the socialization to be good people. And if I could define progress, that's what I would be trying to define progress as a place, we get to a place where we can applaud change and evolution.
Okay, so let me make sure I hear you correctly, Roz. Really provocative. What I think I hear you saying is that you would be more on of the opinion that we ought to strive for interchangeability, or at least an emphasis on commonalities rather than between men and women, rather than an emphasis on differences. Is
and
that fair?
And a commonality on what it is we're striving to achieve down the road. If my objective as a parent and as a commuter parent, as a mother who did it all, as a Southern parent, my objective was to make sure that my child, who happened to be a female, grew up with a great self-esteem and a sense of empowerment and finding her own voice. That would be my... I also have godsons, and that's my same objective for them. And I have students, and that's my same objective for them. So what I'm saying is, when people would say to me, well, you're on the road doing a lecture, who's staying at home with your daughter? Was that
she's
really
22.
A serious question? No, when I was four, when she was four, and I was traveling. I mean, a parent. Because if you say a parent is at home with the child, no one seems to be bothered by that. If you say, well, the father is at home with the child, then we get into these, oh, well, shouldn't the mother be there? I don't know. He knows her routine. He knows how to dress her. He knows how to feed her or make sure she gets fed. So once again, my thought is that 50 years from now, because our children are very different than us, thank God. I'm very different from my mom, thank God. But I think that evolution, and that means change, and the changing roles and attitudes that we have is what should define progress. That's my thought.
Okay, so help me, all of you, wrestle with a problem that my daughter laid in my lap recently in talking about her best friend from college. She's a very high-powered, early career executive who has a longtime boyfriend that desperately wants to marry her but does not have the same earning power that she does. And the question that she's wrestling with is, should I marry him and, in effect, marry down? Which is something that in her way of thinking was not what she was anticipating or expecting. Should I step back in my career and possibly take a less demanding, less paying job so that I don't somehow jeopardize his sense of manhood or whatnot? You had raised earlier, Suzanne, the question of men wanting provider, protector type roles. What advice would you give to a young woman today who's wrestling with the question of, is it okay, or should we aspire to marrying up, marrying down, or marrying across? Does it make a difference?
I think it does make a difference, and I think if you look at the trends that's happening in our society and a lot of other cultures, is that this idea of marrying up and marrying down isn't happening as much, that people, doctors aren't marrying secretaries in either gender, doctors are marrying doctors, academics are marrying academics. So that it's not about gender inequality, equality issues, it's about differences in families now. So there's a wider gap among the families. I think it's hard to give advice to a young woman in this situation, because I think, LaCrae, you mentioned, it's very individual. We can't put our values on someone else. We have to help her discern her own values and what's important to her to help guide her. And I think that's what you were saying, Roz, right, is it's about the self-esteem, and help get that out of her, not put it on her, mm-hmm. which I think is part of the issue. Part of the issue I have is sort of that we're placing on the next generation, like I said earlier, the idea of what feminism is. It's not the same. It's got to change. So
one of the things that's happened over the last 30 years with feminism's drumbeat of telling women, the earlier generation telling the modern generation, the current generation, to never depend on a man, which was a very common theme in modern households. And keep in mind, this is the same group who are essentially the products of the divorce generation. So they don't have any good role models for marriage. On top of that, they were told to never depend on a man and to make their own way and to compete with men and to go out there and have equality. And that changed everything. And one of the things that it did was men heard that message. They heard women say, essentially, you know what? We don't need you. We can make our own way. We can pay our own mortgage. We can have our own babies. Well, not exactly, but we can raise children on our own. Let's put it that way. Basically, there isn't just much we need you for. And they heard that. So they're not striving as much. They're not working to be the provider and the protector because they've been told in no uncertain terms that that's not the way it works anymore. And so what happens is they've lowered their aspirations. And they're not striving for the same thing that their fathers were. And now that they're not, women are saying, now I'm getting to be 25, 30, 35, I'm looking to get married, and there's no good men left anymore. And by good, they mean, guys who can hold a job. You don't necessarily have to be rich, but just hold a job. Rich is good, sure, but hold a job would be great so that I have options in my life. Maybe if I have a baby, I want to stay home with him or her. But I can't do that because the guy can't bring home a paycheck. That's where my work comes in. I'm trying to say, look, we've done something here. We've got to address it.
I don't think during my generation women were aspiring never to be able to depend on a man. I don't remember those conversations. And I asked my daughter this question with her, she's 22, and with her friends and what she thought they were saying. And one of the things she said to me, she doesn't understand this concept of marrying up or marrying down. She thought it was about age. And that's because in their worlds right now, they don't see that economic or the status quo as much as probably they did during my generation. So she said, Mom, the key thing for us is maturity, that we would probably delay having children or getting married until we felt we were more mature. And I said, mature as a woman or mature as a man or both? And she said, basically both. We would like to be secure. We would like to make sure that we've stabilized our situations. And so their decisions are based on a little different conversation. I think during my generation, that conversation was based on the clock, the biological clock. They're in her generation, it's based on a conversation of how can we create a stable home if we're going to introduce children or other people into our lives at that time.
And because we know the clock runs longer now.
And that same group is going to run into that same biological clock. Isn't that interesting?
So
their focus has changed, but they're still going to run into the same biological clock problem.
But the clock is different because the clock before was you've got to have a child by 25. I don't think anyone
We know so much more about it.
We're talking about biological clock in terms of not social expectations of when you have children, but when your body wants to have children and when it stops having them.
But that's also extended.
That's not sociological.
Changed.
That's biology.
But that's changed because of technology and medicine and the expansion of medicine.
Yeah, I'd really like to ask a question that I can't, which is, do you think men in their early 20s today are as mature as they were of another generation? But we're here to talk about women, so we'll save that one for another time, and we'll instead turn to this question. From the audience, this is a really good question. What is the most destructive message that the media is teaching our children about women, and what can we do about that?
That is a great question. I'll start. The thing I think media is teaching young women about being a woman in today is that you have to be a gold digger. You have to have long, swinging, flowing hair. You've got to be pencil thin. You've got to just want to shop in 7-inch heels and get a reality show. And
time out right there. How different is that from 50 years ago? And
I think it's
50 years ago was the year that Betty Friedan wrote her famous book. It was the year the pill was introduced. We've seen there are a lot of things. But go back 50,
well,
go
me,
back 30, go back 10
for
years.
Me 50 years
Have you
ago,
seen Audrey Hepburn's waist?
For me 50 years ago, most of those women were white with blue eyes and porcelain
Thank
skin.
You. So we've
Today,
made,
at least, they are people of color. The richness is from Beyonce to Oprah Winfrey to, so they're all body sizes, body shapes, body styles, lifestyles. They're Southern, they're Northern, they're Eastern, they're a combination. Some may have Puerto Rican fathers and Jewish mothers or some may have African American female mothers and white Anglo-Saxon fathers. So it's a little different.
And it's more hypersexualized. I mean, I think, yes, we were selling sex 50 years ago, but the sex didn't look anything near like what it looks like today. Let's be really honest about that. And the access to that type of information is so much more broad than it was. And I think
You're here arguing for that we've made regress, not progress.
No. In the media?
Yes.
Yeah, I think the media makes... I'm not a big fan of the media. I don't own television and haven't for 4 years for that reason. I do not support mainstream media and their objectification of women or men. And I think we make a big mistake by not teaching kids about media literacy and how to dissect the images that they're seeing. To what you're saying, Roz, they're getting inundated with this through games and music and TV, but they don't know how to digest it and what's real and what's not real. We're not teaching them media literacy. And I think that's doing a lot of harm to our culture.
The biggest media difference today from 30 years ago is selling the notion of the hookup culture, which is casual sex, and singlehood and work for women. That those three things are the be-all, end-all, and that they are going to make you, quote-unquote, empowered, when the vast majority of women, by the time they hit a certain age, those things aren't going to matter to them nearly as much as getting married and having babies. And when they have those babies, they want to take care of them. That is a reality that happens to most women by a certain age. So that all the messages that they're getting from the culture up until the time when they're 30 and decide to settle down or whatever the age is have been completely counterproductive to what they ultimately want.
But Bill, here's the difference that my group of friends and I have taken with this same subject. We do own television. We watch it. But we always take that as a learning lesson. Mm-hmm. If there is a video, and I remember this with my children, and I keep saying my godchildren because there are 8 of those young people that are in my lives that are like my children. Whenever we saw that, we would take that as a moment to say, ask them questions. Start teaching them how to critically analyze and look at those messages, not just say to them, oh, that's bad, it shouldn't be on television, but say to them, wonder why do you all like that? What's important about that? And listen to them and help them understand what that says and how you can acculturate that into your thinking if you don't pay attention and analyze it and do something about it. And then teaching them also the power that they have as consumers, that if they don't like it, they can write a letter or send an email, and encouraging them to do that. I mean, I think those are teaching, but I come from a teaching culture, so we have a tendency to do that.
Teach me. A lot of the confusion that I suspect most men, certainly this man, often experiences in trying to figure out women is knowing which categories are categories about which one should have choice and which categories are categories where there's a right way and a wrong way. And what I hear you guys, I think, all saying, correct me if I'm wrong, is that there's a right way to present women in media and a wrong way. That the sexual exploitation that you're describing that is so rampant today, that was far less common a generation ago, but still existed, certainly, is wrong. And yet you will hear in many locker rooms, male discussion, well, this is just a matter of choice. And women who wish to go on MTV or BET, either way, who wish to allow themselves to be used or to display themselves in this way are just exercising their freedom, their choice. And so the question is, I certainly am not here, believe me, to make a defense for that. Okay, I'm not defending the locker room here, but I do want to hear your, I guess, help me understand, what are the categories about which we should say that's just a matter of choice, and what are the categories where we would say there's really a right way and a wrong way?
Well, there's a way that's going to get you to what you ultimately want. So for women, is it really to have sex with 15 guys? Or is it to find one who's going to love you for the rest of your life? And I would say the same thing for men, ultimately. So if that's the goal that most of us share, then how is the casual sex culture or hookup culture the last 20 years in any way, shape, or form progress?
Once again, I think it's about evolution. It's about the ability for a woman to have the choice.
Choice to
make
to what?
That choice.
Choice to
choose to have a desire to want to get married and have a child, or decide to not want to do that and live a single life. There are lots of women who decide they want to live a single life, but it's choice. It's also trying to making sure that you teach women and give them opportunities that's not the only choice they're left with. Like the question that came, I think, from the audience is that if you're poor and you don't have a choice because of your life circumstances, then there are certain things that you have to do in order to make life work for you. And they may not be things that I like, because those are not the things that I
would. But how would that apply to the topic of sex?
But they still may be things that I have to do it because that's what will make me be able to put food on the table for my children or provide for myself.
But what's it have to do with sex?
Well, I think I think it has a lot to do with sex.
Yeah.
I'll just jump in and say I think that I would even dial it back a little and talk about, you know, when you mentioned the hookup culture, I think that's done a lot of harm as well, the promotion of that. I mean, I see that every day at work, you know, in the disease rates. I mean, I live in Jacksonville, Florida, which you might laugh, but is the chlamydia capital of Florida. And we have a part of Jacksonville that has more chlamydia cases reported than people because it is illegal in Florida to give partner deliver therapy treatment, which is a totally different issue. But I think we've got to go back and talk about how we're talking to kids. I mean, this goes back to the media literacy and how we understand how their brains work to help them deal with these cultural experiences. I mean, the reality is that the frontal lobe of a teen's brain isn't fully developed until they're in their early 20s. They don't understand risk. And so by getting exposed to this hypersexualization culture, they don't see any problem with the risk of getting involved in that. It's like the, you know, I always liken it to the wrecked car during prom, you know, that they dumped on the front lawn. What a teen's brain says is cool, wrecked car, You know, they don't comprehend that could happen to me if I drink and drive. That's why the Just Say No campaign failed. So we've got to go back and understand. It goes to me back to the self-esteem issue, Roz, is that, and we've got to hit this on all fronts. I mean, I think the media issue is big, but we have a responsibility to talk to kids and encourage them and grow their self-esteem so that they have other skills to be able to combat these issues around sexuality, you know, and I do believe in a freedom of choice, you know, and I don't have a problem with sex for sex if it's consensual between two adults. That might be a little progressive for some folks. And sex for love is good too. You know, I mean, I think that's about choice. When you ask what's okay for choice, for me, it's okay to make a choice if you're deciding to have sex for sex or sex for love, as long as you're able to make that choice. And I think the ability to make that choice could, you know, might be questionable with folks based on their own self-esteem. It may look like, you know, women who work at Hooters, you know, you may assume that all their self-esteem is high and that they're proud of their bodies, but maybe not. So I think that...
My question would be to that is, if it's okay for women to make choices, for young women to have their own voice and make these choices, but if it leads to, you know, that means they have the choice of whether or not to sleep with complete strangers after partying with them in a club, that's not progress. And so, or I wouldn't deem that progress. I guess, what would you all deem that? I mean, yes, they have a choice, but when we say it's okay for you to choose who you want to sleep with or how many people, that opens up a whole new can of worms. That goes back, that delves right back into... It rotates right back into self-esteem and, you know, issues like that.
That's so, why we need to be. That's why I think we need to be talking about self-esteem very early with boys and girls. When they get to that point in the club, they have a whole different skill set to be able to discern whether they really want to make that, you know, what choice they want to make.
So the discussion needs to be had before we get there.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point. I really do believe there needs to be more education around self-esteem, pride, and the choices, the consequences, how you make the decision, how you make a decision, and how you get facts and you analyze it. I think we need to teach children and young people, teenagers, how to do that, because that gets to your point about making sure that then when they see drinking and losing control, however you do that with substance abuse or with drinking, can lead to some consequences that then I have to deal with. And understanding all of those, as opposed to, oh, sleeping with the quarterback on prom night might be a cool thing to do. That I think those are the kinds of steps that we have to do and think about, and that's what we get to when we talk about someone having the choice. Yeah, it's understanding what those choices mean and what they lead to.
Let's pick up on this question of choice, and especially as it relates to talking with young people and helping them understand what it means to be male or what it means to be female. And as I consider kind of the last 50 years or whatnot, it was common once for school kids on the playground to recite a little rhyme that went, or that ended, first comes love, then comes marriage, then comes Susie with the baby carriage. There was a cultural script that every young person was handed. They might not like that script, but there was guidance being provided by adults for young people on kind of what adults viewed was the proper order of things, okay? My perception is that today we no longer have cultural scripts when it comes to sexuality. And the question would be, is that progress, or would there be utility in offering guidance to young women in particular as to how to get what you want? What paths lead to success and prosperity? I mean, we have these in the workplace. We say, you know, and with careers, we say, if you want someday to have a good career, then do well in school, go to a good college, study hard, do an internship, advance in your career. We don't really have a path, do we?
No, you don't have.
And is that a problem? Because on the one hand, we're talking a lot about how it's great that we have all these new choices and opportunities. On the other hand,
I wonder, do young people, would young people rather have fewer choices and more guidance?
There is tremendous guidance for what to do in your quote-unquote independent life or your work life or your career or whatever, but there is virtually no guidance in terms of your personal life, and that's where I come in. That, as far as my work goes, I mean, that's what I write about. The choice to have casual sex or sleep around or whatever has always been there. It's always been there. 50 years ago, there were women, girls, who did that. They had a name. That's not the point. The point is the choice was always there. The difference is that the cultural script has changed. As you pointed out, Bill, it used to be marriage and family. Today, it's not. It's sex, it's independence, and it's work. End of story. There is absolutely no script for your personal life. There's no space for marriage and motherhood when it comes to teaching young women about their futures.
Is that bad, though?
Yeah, it's really bad, actually, since most women, that's not going to work for most women.
But if this were a conversation among men, and the question were emphasizing sex, work, and independence, I suspect most men would say, or at least many males would say, hey, yeah, bring it on.
So, and then that gets back to the difference between men and women, what I was talking about originally. I cannot tell you how many women I have heard from, and girls, who have thanked me profusely for the work that I do because there is no voice out there for them as to how they're going to, A, marry their desire for being a wife and mother with their desire for an independent life, number one. And number two, just wanting to be able to say, I want to get married and be a mom. Like it's embarrassing, like it's something that they have to hide. That is what has changed in this country, that the whole focus of relationships, of family, of nurturing has just disappeared, and the focus is on this marketplace or this outside fulfillment that we're going to get that can't possibly match what we can experience in our personal lives. Those two things are separate entities.
Do you see a pendulum swing coming back?
Right. Hang on, we're gonna now bring on our last panelist, who LaCrae is going to introduce in just a second. Let me just say, if you happened to see it last Saturday, she had a very provocative op-ed in the Tallahassee Democrat on this very question about how we measure success and whether we use a male or female understanding of success. So anyway, LaCrae, take it away. Introduce Haley, and then we'll open it up for any questions from our audience.
Great. As he said, I'm going to introduce Haley Cutler to the stage. And Haley is the executive director of the Oasis Center for Women and Girls. While Haley makes her way up to the stage, which she just did, I want to direct your attention to the report in front of you, the executive summary of the Leon County Commission on the Status of Women and Girls.
And Haley, you want to give us a real quick 20-second summation of what the report says, and then we'll continue the conversation.
He's giving me limits because we had lunch, and he learned I don't know how to talk in 20 seconds. So hi, everybody. I'm Haley. And the report.
Yeah, please. She is a real firecracker. You're going to really enjoy her input. Please, jump in.
Thank you. So I would love the opportunity. I want to jump in on that conversation, too. But in the meantime, I would love to direct you to this beautiful document that you have in front of you, which is the executive summary of the report. The Leon County Commission on the Status of Women and Girls is a citizens advisory committee of the Leon County Commission, and this was their work culminating over 18 months of many, many, many woman hours putting that together. And it is a 157-page document summarized there for you in 2 pages and went through all kinds of issues and key indicators about how women and girls are doing in Leon County across health, leadership, economic security, crime and justice, lots of the topics that are coming up in this conversation. And so maybe we can bring some of this to a local lens, and I encourage you to look at what's really going on in our community and how these issues apply. And can I just say to that one question that someone said, I think you were talking about, people were talking about wanting to get married and have children. And I just want to go on, and then the social script around that, that there isn't a social script. And I just want to say, for one, as a young woman, I do want to get married and have children, and I want to work, but I want to work in a workplace that supports that. And so I think that that is a narrative that we can bring all of these issues together with, and something that was really highlighted in this report was the need to create workplaces that are family-friendly and woman-friendly. And so by identifying that family-friendly often means woman-friendly, we can bring a lot of this together. And so I think there is a way we could do that better, so that I could work in an environment that supported my choice to be a mother. And I could marry the person that I want to marry without a social script telling me who or what that should look like.
And so, I want to piggyback on that statement, because I think that is what's going to really be the changing factor, is that when the bosses that become the policymakers for those environments, those workplaces, are from this current generation, your generation, who do value family and workplace and have more of that as part of their value system, and their script is very different from the script their parents and their grandparents had, then I think that you will see that, and I do think that's progress.
Okay, so I just got a great comment from the audience, which of course was a rebuke to me, but that was appropriate. It says, the fact that this conversation has revolved almost entirely on relationships, marriage, and motherhood shows how far we haven't come. So, we're now... All right, we'll excuse
is
the team
that
clapping.
Team clapping? Women in sports.
We'll excuse the team clapping and proceed, though, with a discussion about women in society. And the question that I want us to begin with is one that we prepared in advance. Lecrae, read us that question about women in political life in particular to kick off this part of our discussion.
Which is going to include audience questions very soon, correct, Bill? Yes, audience questions.
Okay.
Yes.
The question, well, let me put the question out there first. 50 years ago, women in public office were a great rarity. Today, the governor and the entire congressional delegation from the state of New Hampshire is female. Is this a sign of progress because women are now wielding power like never before? Or is it a sign of regress because women have bought into a male definition of success?
Once again, I'm going to start that this is progress, in the sense that when you have people that are in powerful positions where they can make the policies, they can make the decisions, they can set the definitions now for the future are going to be different because they're going to come from a different perspective. I don't think any of those women going in are going to rule in the same manner that men did 50 years ago when there may have been one or two women in the Congress. And I certainly know that as they get into leadership positions, the strategies that are used by women to be successful in the workplace are strategies that are going to lend themselves to hopefully a more open conversation and dialogue about tough issues, and look at trying to make sure we can resolve some of these tough issues for the good of a larger group.
So I'm sorry to bring this back to marriage and motherhood, but I'm going to, because the reason why there are not more women in politics, and I don't know how many, well, I'm sure many of you are very involved in that whole process, then you must know how incredibly time-intensive being in politics is. We're not talking a 40-hour work week. Being in politics is all-consuming. I have no issue with women being in politics. That's perfectly fine. Most people would agree. But the reason why more women aren't there is because it takes them away from their kids. Too long. Bottom line. Why is that so difficult to discuss, address, accept? Why are there so many shaking heads? Why is the issue of talking about marriage and motherhood, that's what I want to know, such a bad thing? Why is that a negative? I don't get it.
I don't
Someone enlighten me.
Suzanne, I think the shaking heads, because mine's shaking, but I don't think the shaking heads are not about the motherhood issue. I think it's because I disagree about your reason why women aren't in politics. I think women aren't in politics is because we're scared to elect women into politics and what they might do. And I think that we still have this male-dominated culture that makes a lot of our electorate afraid to vote for women because there's this... I will just say it there. I think there's a pervasive message in the culture about keeping women controlled. And if women get into power and can make those policy decisions, then we can't control them. And I'm sorry, but you cannot ignore what's happening in Congress and states around the country about trying to control women and the choices that they make. So I fundamentally disagree.
I have a very relevant... Okay.
All right.
Okay, I'm going to make a clapping reminder.
Now, but... Liz, give us a question
from the
audience.
I have a very relevant comment question from County Commissioner Kristen Dozier.
Thank you.
Well played. Well played, Liz.
Yes. We were looking at this earlier, and you guys walked right into the topic, so thank you. I could say a lot of things right now, but you all are the panel, so I do want to hear from you. Personally, I think that having... more women involved is more diversity of thought, so we can address problems easier. But I am curious, and you were just getting there, Stacey and Suzanne, that what are some of the barriers that you all think to having more women in politics? Suzanne, I happen to disagree. A lot of women raise their children and then run for office.
I agree,
and
completely.
So that is not the reason why women are not running. So what are some of the other challenges that we have that keep women out of politics? And also, Stacey, to your point, why aren't we more accepting of women coming into politics? And I just want to say, Emily's List had a number at the convention. Over 12,000 men have served in Congress since we founded this country. At that time, this was before the general election, only 277 women had ever served in Congress. Here, I am the sixth woman ever elected since 1845 in Leon County. We now have seven, and these are numbers from the commission's report. Only six city commissioners. This is a very dynamic community. Why don't more women come in, or we vote for more women?
And actually, well, just to tag on to that really quickly, an audience member had a question where she pointed out that some countries actually have quotas. I didn't even know that. Mm-hmm. For male and female leadership positions.
So can I?
Please.
Okay. So at Oasis, we have a project that's been funded by the Knight Foundation now for 3 years called Women Can Run, which is a nonpartisan, non-issues-based program solely geared towards encouraging women to throw their hat in the ring and run for office, build their capacity to make that decision and do that with the training and skills and connections that they need, and to elevate the community's dialogue around these conversations. And in doing that, we've found a lot of things, and to get at Commissioner Dozier's point, about what are the barriers. I think, you know, Stacey, you were talking about an electorate that's afraid to elect women, but one of the key things that we find when you look at the statistics is that women are less likely to run. When they do run, they don't lose elections at a significantly greater rate than men. They are significantly less likely to run. So I think when we talk about the barriers to why there's not more women's representation in elected leadership, we have to look at what are the barriers to getting women to throw their hat in the ring. And I think some of that is what we're talking about now, which are perceived biases in the system would be something that would make me think, do I really want to go up against that? People aren't going to take me seriously. Some of that is that as we are socialized as women, in my opinion, not to see ourselves as the sole solution to a problem, and so we're less likely to wake up in the morning and say, I should run for office today because I could fix that all by myself. And whereas men might be more socialized to see themselves as the solutions to a problem. So I think those are some of those things. And the research is really clear, though. Part of how we fix this is that we encourage women to run, and that women need a lot more encouragement than men to get up there and take that chance, because it is a huge commitment, as Suzanne said. And so the research says you need to ask a woman something like 3 to 5 times.
Ten. You need to ask a woman 10 times to run for office before she'll even consider
taking it seriously. And so
let's start doing that a whole lot more.
And let's also give women access to the power and money that it takes to run for office, because I think that's another really big barrier for women, is that when you look at the budgets that it takes to even, I mean, you look at Florida, where we have the most expensive media market in the country in our state, in South Florida, women to even think about running for office in South Florida have to build, you know, win chests, I don't like to call them war chests, win chests of millions of dollars even to run for a state Senate seat. Let's give women access to that type of power and money. I think that's another huge barrier.
And let's talk about the barrier also of diversity of thought. I really did appreciate your comment about that. We in this country still have not gotten to a place where we can appreciate diversity of thought, diversity of the skill sets that you bring, diversity of experiences. We just are not there. We are more comfortable with the same patterns that we typically have had, which are Anglo-Saxon white men who are sitting in that catbird seat and make all the decisions, and the rest of us, and the rest of us just sit back and say, one day that's going to change. We have got to get to a place in this country where we appreciate a diversity of thought, whether that's from a woman, a person of color.
Someone who doesn't agree with you politically, right?
Yes. Yes, wherever that voice came from, yes.
I wonder as well if we ought to be embracing a diversity of categories of social importance. Because the question I would ask as I listen to this, and I believe me, I voted for Kristen Dozier and proud to say that I did. And in no way am running against the tide on this. But one of the things that I found so provocative about Haley's article the other day is that she was suggesting that there are other categories of how we rate social importance and leadership in a community, in a nation, in a country, in a state, that we don't often, that we're locked into, if you will, a very masculine view, which says, well, if it's political history or military history or economic history, it counts, it goes into textbooks. If it's social history, not so much. Okay? Which leads me to this question. Forgive me, but it was inspired by Suzanne's book. Who's your favorite Kennedy? Who's your favorite Kennedy? Okay, here are your choices. Jack, Robert, Ted, or Eunice Kennedy Shriver?
Carolyn.
Who do you think...
Yeah, I was going to say Carolyn.
No, who of those four, children of Joseph and Rose Kennedy, who do you think made the greatest, most important social difference in our country?
Eunice.
I mean, look, I love Jack, I love Robert, but... Yeah. And yet, who sits around talking about Eunice Kennedy Shriver and putting her in any way in the same conversation with Jack and Robert? Right. Because we've all...
I do.
Okay, Suzanne.
I do. All of my work is about that. That's what I do. It is about women, interestingly enough. It's just about a different kind of woman than the one we're talking about. Wives and mothers do more for this society than a boatload of politicians. That's what I believe. If I'm the worst person in the world sitting up here because I think that, then I guess I am. But I would encourage you to read my work first, think about it from a different perspective, and then come away with your own views. When we talked about research about why there aren't more women in politics, actually what the research shows about what women want when they're polled, poll after poll shows that if they had the choice of their ideal life, it would be to work part-time, if at all, when they have young children, but then throughout the course of their life, even when their children are older, or actually just in general, even if they don't have children, is to work part-time. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal just several months ago about women who were single, who did not have children, who have rejected the whole work, you know, nose to the grindstone, life is all about work mentality that we have in America today. They didn't even have children. They just wanted to take time away to have a life outside of this supposed aspiration to be this amazing thing in terms of money and prestige. There's a whole lot more to life than your job.
And I would say there's a lot of progress being made in that. I mean, just only in my work environment, I see women of both, you know, shades, if you will. It is so important to me as a female leader to beat that drum about work and life balance, because to be cliche, life is way too short to spend it. We already spend enough time at work, but to spend it so much of our time caught up at work to miss the beauty of life, and that all that work is going to be there the next day, you know, so we're learning how to do that. And I think I was going to say this earlier in the evening, but, you know, I mean, this is a movement and things sway, you know, back and forth, and we're finding the right place. Women had to go pretty extreme to get their nose in the crowd, so to speak. And so, you know, they went hard and fast and strong. And not that women aren't hard and strong now, but it's different. And you'll see that sway and come back. And so I think how it is now, you were asking about how it's going to be 50 years from now, it's not going to be that way. We're going to find some balance in this. And that's what I was saying about, you know, allowing ourselves to redefine feminism and not be, you know, stuck in what, you know, our... Not my mom, because she would never call herself a feminist, but and she wonders where I came from. But but you know, for those women who did, you know, our first wave of feminists, it's going to change. It has to.
And that's what I think is the beauty of the value system of millennials and Generation X and the next group that comes over, is that they've seen that there should be a balance and there should be a value of work life and home life and family life, as well as work and vacation. And that's going to be part of their value system. And they're not going to be ashamed of it. And their colleagues and peers are going to understand it and appreciate it.
All right, I got to interject here, because the balance I'm most concerned about right now is the balance between audience participation and panel discussion. And Liz has given me the business. So let's hear from an audience member.
Hi. What I've been looking for since I was probably about 15 is more diversity of choice. And you just started to touch on that, and I'd like to talk about that more if we can. I feel like when I was 15, I thought by the time I was ready to have kids, I would be able to work part-time from home. I would be able to raise my children and bring in some money and have like a full, balanced life. And then in my 30s, I had kids, and I found it very difficult to work and have children. I refused to work full-time. I wanted to work part-time. And it was difficult to command the kind of pay that I should have with my education, because we're not set up for that. We've got computers. Why can't everybody, men and women, why do you have to spend 60 hours a week in an artificial environment? Right. Why can't women especially, who have always worked since the beginning of time, we have always multitasked, we're hardwired for it. Mm-hmm. We can hold a kid on one, you know, hip, yep, and we can stir a pot with the other, and we can be talking into, you know, a Skype with the other and having a meeting with somebody. Why are we not doing this? Why is this not what we talk about all the time?
But we are. I would just use an example about one of my family members who works for Google, who I think is, you know, one of the pioneers in this. And it's going to take some really big companies to pioneer this and be comfortable with remote staff and come and go. And, you know, I mean, my brother who goes to work for Google has a chef on site and a stocked, you know, fridge. It just makes it easier. And the kids can come and be there. So I think we are. I just think it's not, you know, it's not getting trickled down fast enough. But I think it's about, you know, empowering what we were talking about earlier, you know, as we grow, you know, get older and the next wave comes in, more of that's going to happen. We're going to make more room for that. Because wouldn't everybody like to work part-time and have more balance and be earning what they should be, you know, based on their education?
It's definitely easier today than it ever has been, certainly. I mean, all you need to do is go to your local Starbucks and see the cell phones and the laptops, and it's definitely easier today than ever.
So,
go ahead, Haley, and then we're going to hear from another audience member. Go ahead.
Because what I was going to say, I really actually feel really guilty about cutting Rosalind off, because what I was going to say was that I think part of the nature of this conversation I think the importance of choice is really important in creating workplaces and a society that supports flexible workplaces are really important. But I also think that there's an element of privilege in this conversation that needs to be acknowledged, which is that, you know, so we're talking about what it means to be a mother and be working. Well, one of the things that this report found is that in Leon County, 58% of single mothers are living in poverty. Those women are not in the kinds of positions where they can make the choice to stay home part-time. And, I mean, there's huge racial disparities in terms of economic security. And so I think we have to bring that make sure that conversation about what's the right thing for our community inclusive. And so, yes, I think one step is creating workplaces from the top down, and we can demand that from the bottom up that require and necessitate family-friendly policies. But then I also think we have to acknowledge, what about people who aren't working in those environments, and what are we as a community going to do to support them? I think that's really important.
So, great point. All right, jump in, Liz.
Question?
I'm struggling a little bit because I think I'm hearing there's money and prestige, or there's marriage and motherhood, and I'm really struggling with that contrast. And it also gets back to the gender difference question at the very beginning. I think there are human differences, and I think, I'm the mother of this girl right here, who used to be a Village Square volunteer, by the way. yay. And she's in her second year of college, and I would love if she grows up and becomes a mom and has children, but I want her to become all that she wants to be. I don't say, Julie, I want you to grow up and be a mom. I want you to be all that you can be. And I think it would really behoove us to create more emotional intelligence training. We've talked about some of that. More seats at the table, more access to that for males and females, for poor and for rich and for everything in between. I think as a society, we shoot ourselves in the foot when we don't allow each individual to realize their potential. And if that means marriage and motherhood, that's wonderful if that's your passion and your desire. But I disagree with the premise that that's what all women want and that's what will fulfill all women. And so I think that might be where you're getting some of the head shakes. So I totally applaud it. It's one of the most wonderful things I have done. And I love going to work at the hospital and taking care of people in pain. And that really fills me up in a very different way. So it's not one or the other.
So I'm assuming that's directed a little bit toward me, so if I may answer that. I absolutely never said that it should be for all women. Number two, I said most women will want that at some point in their life to be married and have children, even if they postpone it 10 years. What we find that the younger generation now that has been taught to sort of forget about marriage and motherhood and focus on their career or just worry about it later or what have you, as compared to women 30 years ago, have done it to a degree that is ultimately counterproductive, because they're hitting 30, they're hitting 35, and they're saying, uh-oh, I forgot to get married. And they're struggling, and they're saying, wow, I've been groomed for this life at the office to the exclusion of this other thing. So what I'm saying to you is not that it's one or the other. I'm saying if we went overboard in the other way years ago, we're now all the way on the other side.
Which
that's
is really what Stacy is talking about, too, is the swinging.
And I think that it's not the either-or. You know, as a person of color who's also a woman, during the affirmative action, there was a great article that came out that said, all the men are black, all the women are white, but some of us are brave. And that, you know, that gets you to thinking about the fact that it's not either or, it's not right or wrong, it's not men or women, it's not married or unmarried, it's not work or not work, it's not work full-time or part-time. There is a range of things. And so what I'm happy about is the fact that we've not just concentrated on equality, although equality is good, but we've moved to a place where we talk about equity and all the ranges of equity as it relates to equality, because there's a range of things that we have to do. We as a people and we as Americans have to get to a place where we are comfortable with different concepts that are still successful for us as a country. And until we get to that place, until we are able to even have those kind of conversations, which for the most part we're not, then we are going to be stuck, I think, where you were. But for me, success is defined by how well we can get to see and comfortable we can get to seeing an African-American in the White House who leads and we follow. Because For most presidents, that's what America has done. The president leads and we follow. We have discourse about that, the nature of that leadership, and it's okay to have that discourse. We have women who lead corporations, and we have women who lead households. If you've got a woman who is running a household with three children on $14,000 a year, she's got some skills.
Yeah.
Liz, I've got another question.
My question is a little bit more somber, but earlier you made a comment about rape culture, and I wanted to go back to that a little bit and about the gender roles and how they play into that. And earlier you were discussing loosely or strictly defining gender roles, and I just wanted to kind of ask, like, your take on it as a woman in leadership positions on how the rape culture affects that and changes and how we can overcome it. Because oftentimes, like, on a college campus, we're dictated by, you know, what you're wearing or the fact that you went out and drank or the fact that you were with a man or that you knew a man and something happened and he raped you or you were sexually assaulted. And oftentimes, the way the law and the judicial system works, it puts that all back on the woman and the blaming. And I'm not saying it doesn't happen to men either. It's both. But a lot of times, the conversation points negatively back on the woman. And what way can the gender roles overcome that?
So is this for you, Haley? Or did you direct it to any particular anyone?
I would love for Stacey.
Yeah, I'd love for someone to address that and to also perhaps piggyback on that question, and even if you want, address more broadly this question: to what extent are men cooperating with the march for progress here? Do you think men today are far more likely to be of help here, or are they every bit as big a problem today as they once were, and perhaps always will be?
Well, those are a lot of questions, Bill. I mean, I wonder if we have time to answer them all. I brought this up earlier because we cannot ignore. I mean, this rape culture issue is slamming us in the face every day. And I'm getting ready to move to a state where, again, another male has brought up the issue of rape and how a woman's body deals with rape. And he's an elected official. And I just have to say, personally, I do not understand why any man, much less an elected official anymore, is opening his mouth and talking about women's bodies in that way. This goes back to issues of choice for me. And I think that you have to make sweeping generalizations, and I apologize for that, but I don't think that men are helping in this area. I think there are places where individual men and pockets of men and organizations of men are really working hard, and we've got some great legislators that are working on these issues. But when we fail to reapprove the Violence Against Women Act in the House because it adds LGBTs, Native Americans, and immigrants, that's wrong. It is wrong to not protect women's bodies. And it's not just about protecting women's bodies. The Violence Against Women Act empowers the victim because it gives money to support the victim, and it also creates harsher penalties against the perpetrator. And so what message is that sending when our governing body is saying, no, we don't think this needs to still be law. And in fact, we want to get more involved in the decisions that women are making about their bodies. I think it's, you know, I would just have to say we're not making progress in that area. And the media, I'm sorry to go back to the media issue, but I think the media feeds into it. I don't play video games, and I know this is a really old video game, but Grand Theft Auto back in the day. If you ever played it, you could go pick up a prostitute on the side of the road. And you know what? To get more points in the game, if you killed the prostitute after you had sex with her, you got more points.
Right.
That's just a small nugget of what I'm talking about with the media.
Well, and I think the one part of this issue, too, is that it's about power. And it is another one of those little secrets that we don't want to talk about. And the more we deal with that issue, the more we're going to empower the victims, the more we look at those laws and make sure that we're not putting the onus, even though the law technically says that it should be on the criminal as opposed to the victim. We know that the onus is on the victim, and we've got to empower young women, particularly on our college campuses, because I think this is where it gets condoned and sort of okayed in that college culture, and how important colleges are with the socialization. So when we allow students to go out and get drunk, and we allow them to perpetrate crimes or overindulge and engage in risky behavior, then yes, I believe that that's a problem that we have to deal with. But it is around power, and make no mistake about it, power is at the source of that.
I just want to jump in right here and ask, you know, since we're on this topic, how much, and this question is for anyone, how much of a role does the woman's choice, you know, we were talking about earlier how we have choices now, we have a voice. How much do you think that voice and that choice plays into this rape culture? You know, women can choose to wear these really short mini skirts on college campuses. Women choose to, you know, wear tops that expose all, you know, everything. So they can make that choice. What type of role do you all think that plays into this culture that has now, so, that we're in now?
So I personally think that I can choose to walk into this room naked and that I should absolutely 100% be safe from someone else's violation of my body. And so, no pressure at the top. But I think that it's interesting that the original question was posed about the domination of women and largely women when we're talking about the rape culture, but that it comes back to a conversation of woman's choice. I think those two conversations are incongruent. I think that those are two very different conversations, and that we should not have to choose to be safe. That is something that is our inherent right, and that a culture that tells any group of people that they have a right or privilege to dominate another group of people is very problematic. And I think that, can men be partners in making this better? Absolutely. Are some men? Absolutely. I think that a big part of it is social norms changing and changing the dialogue around what is masculine and what is feminine, challenging forms of masculinity that are tough and dominating, challenging forms of femininity that are, it's okay to be any kind of man or any kind of woman that you want, but challenging the social stigma, the social ideology that a woman is by nature more available to be a victim due to her femininity. I think that the idea that femininity equals vulnerability is really problematic. And I think when we get to that power of choice, I think it's just, I walked on the stage right after a conversation about like the sky high heels and the this and that. And I always think it's so funny because I'm such a big proponent of choice and I choose often to fit inside a very feminine box. Like I'm up here in my heels and my pink little dress and I wear makeup and I have long hair and I often choose to fit in that box, but I also would want the right to choose any path, and I don't believe that has anything to do with my right or ability to be safe. I think they're two very
different conversations. We need to go ahead and move towards closing.
I'm sorry, I just have to speak on this because I think you made an excellent point, Heather. I get very concerned when young women think that because they choose to look in a certain way that somehow that invites someone to violate them. As you said, I mean, that was such a poignant point. Please don't ever think that the way you dress invites or gives someone permission to violate you in any way, emotionally, physically, psychologically, at all. That is not me dressing a certain way does not then say open for business and just come as you are, however you want to dominate me. That is not. I hope we're not teaching that. And if we are, that's another reason why education is so important.
We're going to send them to Roz and let Roz straighten them out.
I would love to.
We've had a great conversation, but our time has run to the end. Thank you very much for coming and being a part of this. Please join me in thanking this great group of panelists and Lecrae Mitchell, the next mayor of Tallahassee.